Today is Thursday, July 16th, and this is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, infighting in the White House over how to respond to the world's worst COVID-19 outbreak.
Let's stop this nonsense and figure out how can we get our control over this now.
And Egyptian women speak out against sexual harassment. Plus, a devastating drought in Southeast Asia's Mekong Delta. These stories and more are next. Our top story today, infighting at the White House over how to handle the COVID-19 pandemic has gone public. Officials in and out of the White House have publicly questioned the United States' top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, who is seen as one of the most trusted doctors in the U.S. For more than two decades, Fauci has helped lead responses to disease outbreaks, including HIV, Zika, and Ebola. But Fauci has been increasingly sidelined by U.S. President Donald Trump as he sounds alarms over the COVID-19 coronavirus. White House officials appear to want to discredit Fauci, who has been vocal in his disagreements with the president's enthusiasm for reopening high-risk areas, including schools and sporting arenas. The latest attack on Fauci came from Trump's trade advisor, Peter Navarro. Earlier this week, Navarro wrote an opinion piece in the USA Today newspaper accusing Fauci of being, quote, wrong about everything, end quote, that the two men interacted on. In an interview with The Atlantic magazine, Fauci responded,
"It is a bit bizarre. I don't really fully understand it. Let's stop this nonsense and figure out how can we get our control over this now."
Trump appeared to defend Fauci, saying Navarro should not have written the opinion piece, but President Trump has also complained about Fauci privately for months and publicly in recent days. Earlier this week, the Association of American Medical College's president and chief scientific officer said the organization was, quote, extremely concerned and alarmed by efforts to discredit Fauci. The public spat comes as COVID-19 cases rise in the U.S. Wednesday, the U.S. recorded over 66,000 new cases. There have been about 3.5 million cases in the U.S. total, with over 137,000 deaths, by far the most of any single country. European leaders hold their first physical summit Friday since coronavirus lockdowns began. The goal is to move forward from the pandemic amid sharp differences over a proposed economic recovery fund. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has more on the stakes from Paris.
European heads of state will seek agreement over a proposed $856 billion pandemic recovery fund and to discuss the bloc's next multi-year budget when they meet Friday in Brussels. Neither issue promises to be easily resolved. Backing the recovery package are hard-hit southern countries like Italy and Spain, which would benefit most from the proposed mix of loans, aid, and grants. On the other side are the so-called Frugal Four, the Netherlands, Austria, Denmark, and Sweden, which warn spending must be responsible. Europe's traditional powerhouses, France and Germany, have joined forces to support the package. Even so, Chancellor Angela Merkel of Germany, which currently holds the EU rotating presidency, expressed uncertainty earlier this week that a deal will be struck at the Brussels summit.
I think Angela Merkel is pretty determined to reach an agreement.
Rosa Balfour is director of the Carnegie Europe Research Organization in Brussels.
What she has said, to be cautious, is that if it's not this weekend, it will be in coming weeks.
At stake are many things: European unity, the direction of financial markets, but also lightening up a heavy EU agenda that includes other key issues like finishing up Brexit, Britain's departure from the European Union. Tara Varma, head of the Paris office for the European Council on Foreign Relations, says the final funding agreement may look quite different from the original proposal.
But if ultimately they make it, that is quite a breakthrough. And honestly, it's a big move forward for the Germans also to be able to implement the rest of their agenda, which is quite massive.
There are other stumbling blocks. Some researchers warn the rescue fund will siphon green investments needed to meet the EU's ambitious climate goals. And Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban says he may veto any deal linked to rule of law criteria. Analyst Balfour says EU leaders might bow to Hungary's demands, at least this time.
But in the long term, I do think it's an existential threat for the EU, because the EU is so tied to the fact that it is formed by democracies.
The two-day summit takes place amid EU estimates the bloc's economy will shrink 8.3% this year before growing in 2021. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
France will impose wearing a mask in all indoor public spaces such as shops. Journalist Nicolas Pinault has more from Paris.
The announcement came as Health Minister Olivier Véran noted weak signs of an epidemic resurgence in certain hospitals in Paris and some areas of the country. Masks are already obligatory on public transport but will be mandatory in shops and other indoor places, Prime Minister Jean Castex said in the Senate. The government will establish a list of what constitutes indoor public places and possible sanctions for non-compliance. So far, COVID-19 has claimed more than 30,000 lives in France. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News in Paris.
Azerbaijan and Armenia accused each other of shelling military positions and villages on Thursday, breaking a day of ceasefire between the two former Soviet republics. 11 Azeri soldiers and a civilian and 4 Armenian servicemen have died since Sunday in renewed conflict between countries that fought a 1990s war in the mountainous Nagorno-Karabakh region. International concern is heightened because of the threat to stability in a region serving as a corridor for pipelines, taking oil and gas from the Caspian Sea to global markets. Both countries' defense ministries accused the other of firing mortars from before dawn and encroaching on territory, though there were no casualties reported. Unidentified hackers broke into the Twitter accounts of technology leaders, politicians, celebrities, and major companies Wednesday in an apparent cryptocurrency Bitcoin scam. The ruse included bogus tweets from former U.S. President Barack Obama, U.S. Democratic presidential frontrunner Joe Biden, and a number of tech billionaires, including Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates and Tesla CEO Elon Musk. Celebrities Kanye West and his wife Kim Kardashian West were also hacked. The fake tweets offered to send $2,000 for every $1,000 sent to an anonymous Bitcoin address. There is no evidence that the owners of these accounts were targeted themselves. Instead, the hacks appeared designed to lure their Twitter followers into sending money to an anonymous Bitcoin account. The European Union's top court ruled Thursday that an agreement that allows thousands of companies to transfer data to the United States is invalid because the American government can spy on people's data. The ruling could require regulators to vet any new data transfers to make sure Europeans' personal information remains protected under the EU's stringent standards. It will no longer simply be assumed that tech companies such as Facebook will adequately protect the privacy of its European users' data when it sends it to the US. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. A barrage of Instagram posts accusing a former Egyptian college student of harassing or raping as many as 100 women and girls led to the arrest of Ahmed Bassam Zaki. Now, social media in Egypt is exploding with voices echoing the Me Too movement in other countries, and sexual harassment laws are being amended. VOA's Heather Murdoch has this report from Istanbul with Hamada El-Rassam in Cairo.
It started with an Instagram account, Assault Police, which picked up 165,000 followers in less than 2 weeks. On it, about 100 women and girls claimed to have been harassed, sexually assaulted, or raped by Ahmed Bassam Zaki, a college student, formerly of the prestigious American University in Cairo. Egypt has long struggled with sexual harassment, with one United Nations study showing that nearly all Egyptian women say at some point they have been victims. But 25-year-old Maya Mahmoud says most women don't report assaults or harassment, fearing retaliation or stigma. But this case is different. After the women and girls spoke up, Zaki was arrested, and prosecutors say he will be held for investigation into six separate incidents until late next week. Zaki's family has said very little, but his father did tell one reporter that he thinks the charges are false and that this is an internet pylon. But more accounts keep popping up, with users posting accusations against other alleged sexual abusers in what some commentators are calling Egypt's Me Too movement. Hebe Adel of the Egyptian Female Lawyers Initiative says it's too soon to say how this case will turn out, but it's proving the power of social media in influencing the government. Besides quickly arresting the accused, Egyptian lawmakers have adopted a bill that says victims' names must be withheld from public documents to protect them from threats after they make an accusation. Lawyers say this will encourage more victims to report, but there is still a lot more to do. This is lawyer Karim Azat. He says Egypt needs a separate department to take care of cases that involve violence against women, including rape, harassment, and domestic violence. Prosecutors say Zaki has confessed to blackmailing women and girls, but denies all other charges. Heather Murdoch, VOA News in Istanbul, with Hamada El-Rassam in Cairo.
Across Southeast Asia's Mekong Delta, fishermen, farmers, and their families are hoping the current wet season will end a long-running drought. Its effects are being felt in Myanmar, Thailand, Laos, Vietnam, and in Cambodia, where rainfall has been far short of expectations. For VOA, journalist Luke Hunt has the story from Cambodia's capital, Phnom Penh.
According to the Mekong River Commission, rainfall during May and June was about 70% lower than for the same period a year ago. And that is upsetting people who rely on the river system, which in full flood is bigger than the size of Belgium. Seasoned fisherman Man Lee Hee has plied these waters for decades and is upset with the construction of dams and what is happening along the Mekong River. He says there are no fish because of the new dams, including Stung Treng, which blocked the river flow. Water levels are going up and down three or four times a month, depending on whether the dams are open or closed. He adds this rainy season, there has been no rain. The wet season in Southeast Asia is driven by the Indian monsoon. But scientists say rising sea temperatures in the Indian Ocean is changing weather patterns. This can result in extreme drought, a situation which can only get worse with plans to construct about 140 dams in China and Laos. Yan is a Muslim cham who moved his family back to Cambodia from Vietnam, where he lived during the Pol Pot years. He has lived on a boat and fished for the last 35 years. He says fish numbers have fallen dramatically over the last 5 years and he does not fish anymore. He says he wakes up at 2 a.m. to buy fish at Chang Tramar Fish Market and then sells it in the Kandal Market. He says they only make a small profit because they have to buy fish because there are no fish in the river. Yan says his wife works for many hours in the market while he does other jobs like fixing the boat. She sells in the market in the morning, then he picks her up. They pray after lunch and relax for a few hours, then go back to market and sell fish again. At 8 p.m. they come back home. Yan says life on the Mekong is difficult. Satsmay Raw from Troy Chang Var village has lived on a boat since she was born 25 years ago. She says she has never seen water levels this low. She says the water levels can rise, and when the river turns dark in colour, she can catch fish, maybe 2 or 3 kilograms a day. She adds that she heard that a dam collapsed last year, when the water was too high. The plight of these river dwellers is grim, and it's a situation that is unlikely to change until this drought, already in its second year, comes to an end. Luke Hunt for VOA News, Phnom Penh, Cambodia.
South Korea has pledged to go green by fighting climate change, but plans by a South Korean company to expand a coal-fired power plant on the Indonesian coastal village of Suralaya may undermine that commitment. Reuters' Libby Hogan has more.
Indonesian fisherman Ramadin says he has to go out further and further out to sea to catch the stingray his family has sold for generations. A giant coal power complex has grown nearby over the last three decades, looming over Suralaya village. Ramadin and others there worry about pollution in the air and water, and they fear things are about to get worse. A large state-run power company from South Korea, KEPCO, confirmed weeks ago it plans to add two more 1,000 megawatt units to the plant.
It used to be closer to the shore to get fish, but since those power plants were built, the waste may affect the fish, and they went away.
Beyond the impact to life in Suralaya, South Korea's lead role in the plant seems to run against its commitment to fight climate change. President Moon Jae-in's Green New Deal was first proposed in the lead-up to his party's victory in April elections. It touts new jobs and a net-zero emissions target by 2050. They included loose pledges to end support for coal at home and overseas. On Tuesday, Moon revealed new projects ranging from funds for electric vehicles to tax breaks for telecoms at the cost of nearly $95 billion.
The new projects are expected to create 890,000 jobs through 2022 and 1.9 million jobs through 2025.
Some analysts have questioned South Korea's commitment to fighting climate change and called the Green New Deal an empty promise. KEPCO investors, including asset management BlackRock, have raised concerns about the company backing new coal plants. KEPCO said it takes climate change seriously and that the proposed Indonesian project meets the environmental standards set in South Korea. The Indonesian government also say the new coal units will use the latest technology and minimize pollution. But the potential cost may taint the promise of South Korea's Green Deal. Greenpeace says the $3.5 billion expansion project could result in up to 1,500 premature deaths over the typical 30-year lifespan of a coal-fired power plant. They say even air quality in the capital, Jakarta, could be affected. And locals in Suralaya village told Reuters they're skeptical. Ramadin, the fisherman, says where he once only had to paddle out to fish, he now uses a motor, weaving between vast, uncovered barges stacked high with coal.
Thanks to Libby Hogan of Reuters for that report. 6 months ago, the U.S. and the Afghan Taliban entered a peace agreement. As part of that deal, the U.S. said by this week it would reduce its troop numbers in Afghanistan to 8,600 and withdraw from five bases. The Pentagon announced this week that it has lived up to its commitments, but U.S. Marine General Kenneth Frank McKenzie, who is the head of the U.S. Central Command, accuses the Taliban of not living up to their commitments. McKenzie spoke to VOA's Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb in an exclusive interview via phone from the region on Wednesday.
Has the Taliban kept up their commitments, in your opinion?
So I would not say that they have yet. We expected to see a reduction in violence. And while the Taliban have been scrupulous about not attacking U.S. or coalition forces, in fact, the violence against the Afghans is higher than it's been in quite a while. It's one of the highest, most violent periods of the war that we've seen to date. Average lethality is down just a little bit, but the number of enemy-initiated attacks is in fact, very worrisome. We need to get to intra-Afghan dialogue. It is uncertain that we're going to get to that at any time soon. That's really the next critical thing that needs to happen. And that's what leads us to the long-term conditions that would allow us to actually see a future where there's far less U.S. or coalition presence in the country.
How confident, General McKenzie, are you this far into the deal that a peaceful resolution can stem from this? Or are we on the verge of a reset?
Now, I wouldn't say that I'm confident or not confident. we don't need to believe in the Taliban. We don't need to like or dislike the Taliban. We need to study and observe the Taliban and see if they keep their commitments and move forward. And I think, honestly, the government of Afghanistan is trying very hard to do, you know, what they've undertaken to do as part of the agreement. I think right now the Taliban is not in the same place, and so that's how I draw my assessment of what the future is.
What's the repercussion to the Taliban if they're not being helpful? What does the U.S. military plan to do if they're not helpful and they're not keeping up to their commitments?
Carla, that ultimately is going to be a political, not a military decision. But if the Taliban envision a future where there's very little or no foreign presence in Afghanistan, then they have to create the conditions for that. And the conditions for that would be an agreement with the existing government of Afghanistan, a way forward that has a significant reduction in violence, and absolute promises that are verifiable to ensure that Al-Qaeda and ISIS have no safe haven in Afghanistan.
You had asked your team to further dig into the matter of Russian bounties being offered to the Taliban in exchange for the deaths of U.S. service members. Have your people found any more evidence to back up that initial report?
So, Carla, I asked that question back in January, you know, when I first received the report. And so we are continuing to dig. I have found nothing yet that would make me change my judgment that it is very worrisome, it's very concerning, but it's not proven to my satisfaction that actually occurred. We've really looked hard. We continue to look. As we continue to look at a broad variety of things. But I've got nothing back yet that would change my judgment on it.
You know, General, I was in Afghanistan with General Nicholson back in 2017 when he was telling reporters that the U.S. had continued to get reports of the Russians arming the Taliban. What makes the idea of offering bounties so different than arming the Taliban to fight against the U.S. forces?
I think it's the human connection that you tie it to wanting to kill a specific kind of person, a specific American or a specific Afghan. I think that's what it makes it, frankly, you know, morally abhorrent and against the Western way of war. We would not. So I find it particularly distasteful to even consider that. Look, we know Russia does not mean us well. We know that. They are not our friends. I've said this before. They have no interest in our success in Afghanistan or in a lot of other places as well. So it should not surprise us, and it does not surprise me that they work against us. That's just a given.
That was U.S. Marine General Kenneth Frank McKenzie speaking to VOA's Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb. That's it for our show today. Thank you for listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our entire team, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Malawi, at long last, has a newly sworn-in president following a 13-month election process. On June 23rd, opposition leader Lazarus Chakwera won the country's rerun presidential vote, defeating incumbent president Peter Mutharika with more than 58% of the vote. The first presidential election was held back in May 2019, when President Mutharika claimed a narrow victory. But Mr. Chakwera, who came in second place, alleged voter fraud and appealed to Malawi's constitutional court. The court found evidence of widespread irregularities and in February 2020 ordered a new election to be held. Malawi is only the second African nation to annul a presidential election over irregularities, following Kenya in 2017. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo expressed admiration for the commitment to the rule of law and democracy exhibited during Malawi's presidential elections.
The people of Malawi elected Lazarus Chakwera as their next president. This is only the second time in Africa that a court has overturned a presidential election tainted by irregularities, and the only time that a re-election process has resulted in an election of an opposite party candidate. Truly a historic opportunity for the people of that country.
President Chakwera has called the election a win for democracy and justice. In his inaugural address, he promised not to put himself above the rule of law. This means that as required by law, I will make a full declaration of my assets each year. I will go to Parliament to be questioned by the people about my handling of state affairs. I will propose legislation to reduce the powers of the presidency and empower institutions to operate independently, including Parliament and the Anti-Corruption Bureau. This is an historic opportunity for Malawi to work toward a future of greater prosperity, government accountability, and freedom.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.